when they come to do the thing they love doing?
Well, I think it's a reflection of where we are as a society in some respects. I don't think it's any better or any worse, actually. I mean, I think... I was just reading this morning that the incidence of stop and search of black people in London has gone up by 24%.
It's not nice. It shouldn't be happening. And the fact that it keeps popping up is disgraceful.
Well, it doesn't say anything nice, but it's not like other countries don't have it. Like, it's not a British problem. It's, I think, it's a problem that every nation has, whether it's in sports or, I don't know, the show business, anything public.
No, it's the same all across the world, I think. Don't matter just this country. It might be more publicised in this country, but it happens all over the world.
They always try to harm me, and that's, I think, is another face of like London or like the UK. Because, yeah, I have all this stuff that you're saying, but I also experience like the way that people harm me a lot, and people has been being so helpful.
Well, Britain knows is there, is the head, and people are looking over, you know, up to them for good behaviour and really giving people the satisfaction they want and tackling things like racism as it should be. So they should do better than this.
So what does racism in sport say about racism in Britain on the international stage?
Well, it's worrying, isn't it? It is worrying.
It gives a very negative reputation about the British society. The British society is a good place, it's a nice place to stay, to live, an organized society. But I think there are a few members of the society here who are practicing such racism that seems to be done by majority of the society of Britain, which is not the majority that practice that racism. It's just a few of them, but it's just that the few people that practice the racism here, they are dominant. That is the thing.
I think Britain is not as racist as other places. However, is it perfect? No. So it is a landmark, but it's got some stains on it, so it can be cleaned.
You know, the UK is part of the United Nations Security Council, and we've seen how they have undermined other countries at the international level, you know, with their culture, you know, the capitalistic, vicious capitalistic domineering culture, and it just transpires at the local level.
Yeah, I think the world is watching. The world is watching to make sure that we change our processes, and it's within cricket today, the meeting of every county board, all aspects of cricket has come to a conclusion that things need to change and things need to, and we need to engage with people. We need to actually engage and say, how can we make this right?
The evidence given by cricketer Azeem Rafiq confirms what many cricket players, footballers and other sports people have known for years. Racial abuse in Britain is widespread and committed by both players and fans. Many have their own stories of abuse to tell and can confirm that racist behaviour is frequently dismissed as a joke or not taken seriously by the organising, governing bodies of the sports.
These damaging revelations of a culture of racism in cricket, football and beyond suggest a deeply established presence of religious and ethnic abuse in British sport. And despite words of outrage from sports bodies and politicians, it still continues after all these years. Either because, at least until now, the sporting world couldn't put a stop to it, or because, quite simply, it hasn't cared enough to really try.
Thank you.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A New York judge has ruled that former U.S. President Donald Trump will have to testify in his fraud investigation, leaving him sweating and his investors shaking their heads. We're prepared for you an article written by Lloyd Green, an attorney in New York who was opposition research counsel to George H.W. Bush's 1988 campaign and served in the Department of Justice from 1990 to 1992. The piece is titled, "It's Trump's Time to Tell the Truth, the Whole Truth and Nothing But the Truth." Former U.S. President Donald Trump's bad luck continues. On Thursday afternoon, 17th of February, Arthur Engoron, a Manhattan judge, gave the thumbs up to subpoenas issued to Trump, favored child Ivanka, and Donald Trump Jr. by Letitia James, New York's Attorney General. The court's ruling follows a decision by Trump's accountants to walk away from the one-term president and disavow years of financial statements issued by his company. Much as the Trump trio tried, they could not shut down Letitia James's investigation into the Trump Organization's business practices, which could lead to a civil lawsuit by Letitia James. Unlike a criminal prosecution, a civil action comes with a lower burden of proof for the government. At the same time, civil lawsuits can drag on, like right into 2024. Barring a stay, Donald Trump and his two children have been ordered to appear at deposition within 21 days. If they tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, who knows what liability may result? On the other hand, if they invoke their right to remain silent, they will probably be portrayed as criminals. Donald Trump observed on the campaign trail in 2016, he said, "You see, the mob takes the Fifth," adding, "If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?" But time surely flies, and if the Trump family refuses to appear at deposition or simply stays mum when grilled, they risk being charged with contempt, a distinction presently held by Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's White House counselor and 2016 campaign guru. At this moment in time, Donald Trump must be sweating while his lenders have to be shaking their collective heads. How much is Trump worth and how bad can things get are no longer hypothetical issues. In the absence of operative financial statements, restructuring and bank called defaults have spilled into the realm of the real. As one Trump insider confided, "Hey, this might be serious. Could Donald Trump and his business be screwed? I don't know, but I'm not as confident as I once was in saying no." Meanwhile, 2024 Republican presidential aspirants are likely stifling a collective smirk. Trump's legal woes stand to broaden the Republican Party's presidential field, and for some, it is downright personal. For Mike Pence, Donald Trump's hapless vice president, these recent developments may well trigger a sense of schadenfreude. It wasn't that long ago when Trump's loyalists came with makeshift gallows for Mike Pence as they stormed the Capitol, and Donald Trump said nothing to deter the mob. Instead, he demanded loyalty from his number two. As for Ron DeSantis, Florida's governor, Donald Trump's troubles could not come at a better time. Trump has all but called DeSantis a coward for refusing to say whether he was vaccinated. Beyond that, Florida's recent per capita COVID mortality rate is the seventh highest in the United States, and Ron DeSantis is having a hard time denouncing neo-Nazi violence. The Sunshine State's governor declared, "So what I'm going to say is these people, these Democrats, are trying to use this as some type of political issue to try to smear me as if I had something to do with that," adding, "We're not playing their game." To be sure, Donald Trump's MAGA base would stick with him through thick and thin. The party's deep-pocketed donors are a different story, though. Donald Trump may have delivered them a trove of tax cuts and ambassadorships, but he's emotionally draining. Beyond that, his antics in the run-up to the 2020 Georgia runoff elections cost the Republicans control of the Senate. There are reasons Mitch McConnell rejects Trump's lie that the election was stolen and is seeking to bypass the 45th president. Thursday's ruling was scathing. At one point, the court concluded that the Attorney General had uncovered copious evidence of possible financial fraud. Elsewhere, the judge excoriated Donald Trump and co. for their flight to fancy and fiction, invoking Alice in Wonderland, 1984, and Kellyanne Conway all in a single sentence. The judge said, "The idea that an accounting firm's announcement that no one should rely on a decade's worth of financial statements that is issued based on numbers submitted by an entity somehow exonerates that entity and renders an investigation into its past practices moot is reminiscent of Lewis Carroll's, when I use the word Humpty Dumpty said, "It means just what I chose it to mean. Neither more nor less." George Orwell, "War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength," and alternative facts. In the past, Donald Trump managed to weather storms surrounding his finances and credibility. Trump University did not stop the ex-reality show host's political ascent. What happened next remains to be seen. Right now, Joe Biden's poll numbers are in the low 40s, inflation is on the loose, and Nancy Pelosi is poised to lose the Speaker's gavel. Against that tableau, Donald Trump poses a distraction from Republican ambitions, an unwelcome detour from anticipated outcome. Moreover, the recent development presents the former US president with a dilemma. Should he invoke his right to silence by pleading the fifth? What does pleading the fifth mean? The right of any person to decline to answer questions put to them in criminal proceedings flows from the Fifth Amendment of the US Constitution, hence pleading the fifth. The amendment, dating back to 1791, protects individuals from self-incrimination. It says, "Nor shall any person be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself." Technically, the financial investigation into the alleged fraudulent accounting of the Trump Organization is being conducted by Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, as a civil case, and as such is not covered by the right to silence. There is a complication, though. Letitia James has made clear that she is working in unison with the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, who is also looking into Donald Trump's finances, but as a criminal matter. On Thursday, 17th of February, just hours before Judge Arthur Engoron ruled that Trump and his children, Donald Jr. and Ivanka, had to present themselves for questioning, the former president's lawyers protested that he was being put in an impossible bind. Alina Haber, one of Donald Trump's legal team, told the court, "They neither disclose evidence in a civil investigation or they have to invoke the constitutional right not to testify, thereby triggering an adverse inference in the civil action. How is that fair, Your Honor?" Does pleading the fifth imply the witness is guilty? In law, not at all. U.S. law could not be clearer. Invoking your right not to answer a question in a criminal case says nothing about your guilt, and no inference may be drawn from it. The Supreme Court has underlined that point several times. For instance, in the 2001 ruling Ohio v. Reiner, the justices stated that one of the Fifth Amendment's basic functions is to protect innocent persons who might otherwise be ensnared by ambiguous circumstances. Of course, what the law says is not the end of the calculation. Witnesses have to weigh up how a jury might respond were the case to go to civil trial, as Donald Trump's might. If you are a politician like Trump, there is also the vexed issue of public opinion.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
World leaders participated in the 58th Munich Security Conference in Germany, which is held annually. This year's conference was dominated by the Ukraine crisis, as major Western powers accused the Kremlin of zeroing in on an imminent invasion of Ukraine. In the conference, the U.S. Vice President, Kamala Harris, announced that Washington and its allies will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs on Russia if it further invades Ukraine.
We will impose far-reaching financial sanctions and export controls. We will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries.
Harris also added the U.S. will not stop with economic measures, but will further reinforce the eastern flank of NATO. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the United States are on high alert. Also, another high-profile attendee in the 2022 Munich Security Conference, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, said Britain could block Russian companies from raising capital in London and has passed legislation to widen sanctions on Russian businesses and individuals if the country invades Ukraine. Johnson also stated that Russia would pay a heavy military price if it invaded Ukraine. Britain has already sent hundreds of troops to Poland to support NATO's eastern flank. However, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Eisinger, has highlighted the need for dialogue to resolve the differences. He said our world is in danger, traditional certainties are crumbling, threats and vulnerabilities are multiplying, and the rules-based order is increasingly under attack. He noted that the need for dialogue has never been greater. Meanwhile, Russia has time and again denied any intention to invade its western neighbor. It argues that it's deployed the military near Ukraine's borders to protect itself amid NATO's eastward expansion. Also, in a major step toward de-escalation, last week Moscow withdrew some of its troops near the Ukrainian border after completing military exercises. The U.S. President Joe Biden has ramped up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tension in Eastern Europe. He once again repeated his claim that Washington had intelligence showing his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has made up his mind to invade Ukraine.
We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
Speaking at the White House, Biden warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries won't deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster their defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of EU's oil imports and 40% of EU's gas imports.
I don't think Russia cares so much and worries so much about Western sanctions, because Russia proved for the years, in spite of Western pressure and different sanctions, capable to sustain and even improving slowly, not so good as before, its economy. So sanctions are not the main threat to Russia.
The U.S. accuses Russia of planning an attack on Ukraine, but Moscow says that is not true. Therefore, the latest warnings, based on unfounded accusations that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is just around the corner, would further complicate the situation at this critical time.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the Strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv, Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
The MKO terrorist group appears to be expanding its operations to include trafficking, among other criminal activities. An Albanian historian and journalist says the country's police have alerted the U.S. Embassy that members of the terrorist organization are involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. Alsi Jazeshi, citing Albanian media reports, says the MKO operatives, headed by the terrorist ringleader Marjan Rajavi and based in a camp near the capital Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 of the group's own members to France. Jazeshi added that a number of the terrorist cult's members have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, who were most likely Daesh terrorists. The journalist also says some senior MKO members, including the ringleader's sister-in-law, have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs into Italy, with police having prosecuted another member over theft charges. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. The journalist says the terror group has forced an Albanian media outlet to take down an article it published about the arrests.
They used Albania as a safe haven to carry out illegal activities and criminal acts. And now they are becoming a problem for Greece, Italy, Germany, and France. And when I say problem, not just trafficking human beings, drugs, money laundering, and some other activities. They have become a problem for Albania for the crimes I just mentioned, but also burglary, pickpocketing, harassing women, sexual harassment, and at least one case of rape.
Critics in Albania blame the United States and its Western allies for providing protection for the terrorist cult. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 28, 1981,
when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Most recently, Iran said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in November 2020. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
Some of them have their hands stained with blood. Some of them have battlefield experience. Some of them have some formal training by Mukhabarat, the special secret police of Saddam Hussein. So they are not just two people trying to go to Europe to make a living. They are a danger. Criminals need to go to prison, not to roam in the streets of European cities. Absolutely. This is my idea.
Since removing their decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. But the latest revelations about the terror organization can serve as a wake-up call for its Western supporters that the threats they have been brewing against Iran will backfire on them.
The government of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in trouble. His cabinet has invoked a rarely used emergency ordinance to quell anti-vaccine truck protests that have crippled the country. The Emergency Act can authorize the use of the military. It can also temporarily suspend citizens' rights to free movement or assembly, and the government is taking steps to stop financial support of illegal protests. The measure allows Canadian banks to freeze accounts suspected of funding the blockades and suspend insurance on vehicles in the protests. Trudeau has noted that the measures will be time-limited, geographically targeted, as well as reasonable and proportionate. The Canadian law, which was passed in 1988, says, "For the purpose of this act, a national emergency is an urgent and critical situation of a temporary nature that cannot be effectively dealt with under any other law of Canada." Trudeau said, "The government is not overriding the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, nor limiting the right to peaceful assembly."
The federal government has invoked the Emergency Act to supplement provincial and territorial capacity to address the blockades and occupations.
The plan has drawn widespread condemnation from Canadians, including the Premier in Quebec, Francis Legault, who said Trudeau's announcements risk putting oil on the fire. The trouble all began after thousands of protesters in trucks and other vehicles blocked the streets of Ottawa, as well as two border crossings with the U.S. to vent their frustration over COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The protests have not stayed in Canada, though. Similar freedom convoy protests have grown in countries like the U.S., France, New Zealand, Australia. As common with protests, many have also vented their anger against the government due to their economic situation as a result of COVID-19.
Spontaneous thing where people are upset. That's one whole part of this, and it's part of a general movement, I think, that we're seeing around the world of the ultra-right asserting itself and using the money of the millionaires to do it.
The so-called Freedom Convoy protests started with truckers protesting COVID-19 vaccine or quarantine mandate. It then broadened to include people opposing all coronavirus-related restrictions announced by the Trudeau government. The protest has attracted the support of thousands of Canadians, even some who are fully vaccinated. They say all COVID-19 preventive measures must be dropped. The protests have drawn support from groups from the U.S.
Having is a right-wing attack on all kinds of things, because one of the demands of the people in Canada was that Trudeau should resign, and the other was that the western part of the country should secede. So, you know, these are not just little political things. So you have, in Canada in particular, the implementation of a very conservative right-wing agenda. And everybody agrees on that, especially the right wing who's doing it. So this isn't just some kind of, you know, spontaneous thing where people are upset.
Canadian authorities have said about half of the funding for the protests has come from U.S. supporters. Toronto Dominion Bank last week froze two personal bank accounts that received $1.4 million Canadian for the protests. In the western Canadian province of Alberta, police have broke up a group that was armed and prepared to use violence. The protests that have hindered traffic at border crossings have impacted more than $500 million in commerce each day.
I think that what happened was that the automobile companies complained. You know, there's production shut down, millions of dollars lost. And it was pretty clear that that was very unpopular. And he waited long enough for the economy to be heard and people to be heard and said, enough's enough. And I think the balance of force has changed a bit because of that.
Truckers and their supporters have gathered in the capital, Ottawa, since January 29th to rally against mask mandates, lockdowns, restrictions on gatherings, and other COVID-19 preventive measures. Some downtown Ottawa businesses have had to shut down temporarily. There have been reports of rock throwing, property damage, harassment, and even hate crimes.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today we are going to touch upon the last parts of Imam Khomeini's testament where he addresses the Iranian nation. The Imam reminds the Iranian nation about the cost they have paid and the hardships they have endured to overcome the enemies and to achieve victory. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, addressing the Iranian nation, writes in his testament that the pains and sacrifices are the cost for reaching lofty goals. He writes, "Once more, in the end of this testament, I make bequest to the Iranian nation that, in this world, the magnitude of tolerating troubles, pains, sacrifices, and deprivations are compatible with the magnitude of the goal and its value and lofty degree. What you, the noble and Mujahid nation, have risen for, have been pursuing and sacrificing your life and property, is the loftiest, highest, and most precious goal and purpose which has been and will be presented since the advent of the world till the end. And that is the school of divinity, in the broad sense of it, and the concept of monotheism with its exalted dimensions. The school of divinity and monotheism mentioned by Imam Khomeini has its roots in the belief that Allah is the only being who deserves to be worshipped. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, "The school of divinity in its broad sense and the concept of monotheism with its exalted dimensions is the basis of creation and its ultimate point in the vast arena of being and the degrees and ranks of the unseen and the seen. And it has been manifested in the Muhammadan school in its full sense, degrees and dimensions, and all efforts of great prophets, greetings of God upon them, and the great friends of God, greetings of God upon them, have been made for that, and without that it will not be possible to reach the absolute perfection and the infinite majesty and beauty. It is that which has made the inhabitants of the earth superior to the denizens of the ethereal heavens. And what the inhabitants of earth achieve in this journey will not be achieved by any creature in the whole creation, publicly or secretly." Imam Khomeini says that the Iranian nation is marching in the way of the divine prophets. He writes, "You, the Mujahid nation, are marching under the flag which is hoisted throughout the material and spiritual world. Know it or not, you are covering the way which is the only way of all great prophets, greetings of God upon them, and the sole way of absolute salvation. It is through this motive that all friends of God hog martyrdom and consider the red death sweeter than honey. And your youth in the battlefronts have drunk a sip of it and have become rejoiced. And it has been manifested in their mothers, sisters, fathers, and brothers. And we should truly say, we wish we were with you to achieve a great victory. May that soothing breeze and that zealous manifestation be sweet for them." Imam Khomeini explains that the spirit of devotion and cooperation ruling in the society is one of the manifestations of this sweet sense. He writes, "We should know that this manifestation can be clearly seen in hot farms, in breathtaking factories, in workshops, in centers of industry, invention and innovation, and among the majority of the nation in markets, streets, villages, and on all those who have overtaken these affairs to serve Islam, the Islamic Republic and progress and self-sufficiency of the country. And as long as this spirit of cooperation and devotion is there in the society, the dear country is, God willing, immune against every harm. And thank God, the seminaries and universities and dear youths of the centers of knowledge and education enjoy this divine unseen blessing." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, continues in his testament, "My bequest to all is to advance with Almighty God's remembrance towards self-recognition, self-sufficiency, and independence with all their dimensions. And undoubtedly God's hand is with you. If you be at his service and continue the spirit of cooperation for the progress and sublimity of the Islamic country, with the wakefulness, vigilance, devotion, self-sacrifice, and the spirit of resistance and resolve that I see in the dear nation in the way of truth, I hope that, through Almighty God's favor, these human concepts will be transmitted to the posterior of the nation and every generation will enhance it. Imam Khomeini ends his testament with these words: with a calm and confident heart, happy spirit, and an inward hopeful of God's favor, I take leave from the sisters and brothers and travel to the eternal abode while I am in urgent need of your good prayers. And I plead with God, the compassionate and the merciful, to accept my apology for coming short of service. And I hope that the nation will accept my apology for shortcomings and faults. They should go forward with power and resolve, knowing that with the departure of a servant, there will be no crack in the iron dam of the nation, as there are more superior servants at the service. And Allah is the guardian of this nation and the oppressed of the world.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
People in the blockaded Gaza Strip staged a sit-in to support Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails and detention centers. During the sit-in, people shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded the release of all Palestinian prisoners. Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians.
The suffering of Palestinian prisoners has increased in recent months, especially following the Bold Escape operation in September. Prisoners, including women and children, suffer every day inside Zionist jails. The Zionist crimes against the prisoners must stop.
The sit-in comes at a time when hundreds of Palestinian detainees have been denied proper medical treatment in Israeli jails. Over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Palestinian Ministry of Health condemned Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian prisoners, especially those suffering from chronic medical conditions.
For Palestinian inmates, Israeli prisons serve as gateways towards their death because of medical negligence. Currently, there are 700 very sick Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli prisons without proper medical care. Those sick prisoners are dying slowly as the world watches in silence.
Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers where they are denied basic human rights. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
We call on the Red Cross and all international organizations to help Palestinian prisoners, especially those who are sick in Zionist jails. We demand international protection for Palestinian prisoners. They are suffering because of the racist Zionist practices.
People here are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help Palestinian prisoners.
According to prisoners' advocacy groups, there are thousands of Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons under inhumane detention conditions. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The third edition of the annual conference on Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, dubbed General Soleimani and New Islamic Civilization. The conference was held online this time, with 50 scholars and political pundits from across the world giving speeches.
General Qasem Soleimani is a martyr, and he died fighting the head choppers and the throat slitters. and a brave, a charismatic leader. And we all honor his life.
General Soleimani was the spearhead of the fight against terrorism and the guarantor of regional stability. Should Iran and Russia have sat on their hands and not defeated the terrorists in Syria and Iraq, they would have had to fight them in their own soils.
We know that the U.S. and some other countries used terrorism under the banner of religion to topple the Syrian government and move the battlefield to Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and the entire region. But Soleimani shattered all the U.S.'s calculations.
Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations.
The security of the Zionist regime is an important issue for all of the American governments. What General Soleimani did was to put Palestine in top of the Muslim world's priorities. And then he gathered and united all of the groups that opposed Israeli occupation as the resistance axis. This was the major motive for the U.S. to assassinate him.
Iran and Iraq have set up joint investigation committee on General Soleimani's assassination. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, 120 people have been identified in connection with Soleimani's assassination. Former U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list.
Iranian and Iraqi judicial teams are seriously following up on a legal pursuit to bring the culprits to justice. Iraq is where the assassination took place and has so far kept close cooperation with Iran. In the four-day conference, we're also going to discuss legal dimensions of Soleimani's assassination.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists.
General Soleimani's assassination gave a clear clue about who is who in the fight against terrorism in the region. The United States killed the nemesis of Daesh, and that puts Washington on the terrorists' team. This, as Iran is firmly following up on its legal pursuit to bring the perpetrators to justice, saying this is to make sure that such incidents will not happen again against Iranian military figures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Cleaning up the mess left behind by Storm Eunice that battered the UK this week. With record speeds of nearly 200 kilometers per hour, much of the country from Scotland to England felt the force of the storm's temper. Footage posted to social media showed trees fall, history be realigned, railway travel disrupted, planes struggling to land, iconic landmarks damaged. The capital, London, issued its first ever rat severe weather warning. Here, too, authorities asked residents not to leave home.
So the message to Londoners is, whilst the Met Office has the red weather warning, stay indoors. A Storm Eunice is the worst storm we've faced in 3 decades. It's really important we don't inadvertently put ourselves in harm's way by being outdoors.
Many heeded the warning and stayed home. Others did not. 3 people were killed.
One of those killed, a woman in her 30s, traveling in a car with a man of the same age here in North London when this tree fell onto their vehicle, killing her, but sparing her partner.
Eunice knocked out electricity for tens of thousands of households on its path. The government had already been warned that the UK lacks the resilience to deal with storms, particularly in terms of electricity infrastructure. Here in London, there is a sense of worry about what's to come next.
I guess you're just not really used to it happening, and I guess it's just one of those things that's going to happen more often, and we need to do more to be prepared to deal with them.
I'd say it's quite concerning because it kind of makes me think of the bigger picture of where the entire climate is headed, where we're headed as a species.
Everything was just in disarray. It was crazy and chaotic, and I know a lot of people felt scared.
Eunice was predicted to be the first storm in 30 years and certainly won't be the last. The clear-up phase is well underway now, but the wider debate about the state of the UK's resilience against storms is only just gathering pace. Saeed Pourreza, London.
On Friday, school pupils held protests in over 40 cities across Italy, demanding the government to put an end to obligatory work placements in the last 3 years of school. The demonstrations were staged after a student, 16-year-old Giuseppe Lenoci, died in a road accident on Monday while he was on board a truck for a school work internship. Last month, another student, 18-year-old Lorenzo Perrelli, was crushed to death by a steel girder of 150 kilos while working in an internship for a private company.
È una vergogna.
They should be ashamed. School principals should be reported to the authorities for striking deals with private companies without being provided assurances on working conditions in factories. They have been reckless and should be punished.
Lavoro non pagato, praticamente sfruttamento.
Schoolwork internship is equivalent to unpaid work. It is just another form of exploitation. In most cases, it doesn't give anything to students. It only helps companies make more profit.
About 3,000 students gathered in central Rome demanding the government to remove the education minister and scrap obligatory work experience programs for high school students introduced by former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi in 2015. In Turin, tension and anger went out of control when a group of students tried to break into the local headquarters of industrial employers group Confindustria and were repelled by police with some batons being wielded, with at least 7 officers being hurt.
We are staging protests also to raise awareness over our living conditions as young adults. Our generation is suffering greatly also from the anti-COVID measures, which restricts our freedom to move, to interact socially. We are left alone with our phones following school lessons online, with our psychological scars, and the government is not doing anything to help us.
School dropout levels in Italy are among the highest in the EU, and due to the pandemic, with the government quickly deciding to make all learning remote. Also, the cases of social withdrawal and self-harm among young people are on the rise, healthcare professionals are warning. In the past 2 years, and especially in recent months, Italy has been the scene of protests across the country. Rallies have been held against deteriorating living conditions, mandatory vaccination and health passes, as well as what the protesters describe as the government's mismanagement of the COVID pandemic. Max Civili, Rome.
Dozens of Nigerian Muslims, mostly supporters of prominent cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki, demonstrated in Abuja to condemn Saudi Arabia for the war on Yemen and its continued blockade of the impoverished country. They said the bombing of civilian targets by the Saudi-led coalition and its siege on Yemen has caused a serious humanitarian situation there.
A coalition of Saudi Kingdom and that of United Arab Emirates, we are launching a strike on the innocent people of Yemen. They have been killing a lot of women, children, men, and everywhere, at their houses, at their business places, hospitals, schools, everywhere. Nowhere is safe in Yemen. They are killing, and the world is silent.
The Saudi war has escalated recently as Riyadh has intensified its aerial and ground attacks, worsening the humanitarian situation in Yemen. The protesters said the ultimate goal of Saudi Arabia is to reinstate the former Yemeni president.
They want to return Mr. Hadi back to power. You can't return somebody back to power with killing those people you want him to come and rule. You are killing them and you want him back to come and do what? What is he coming back to do? To come and rule who? Innocent people or dead bodies?
The protesters said human feeling should prevail over the intrigues of the power struggle on the situation in Yemen. They added that the senseless shelling of innocent civilians in Yemen must stop, while the international community has a moral responsibility to put a stop to the carnage. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
A new report, an assessment of the British government's widely criticized multi-